Thank you very much. That was awesome. We're going to be open to discussion or questions now. We'll try and keep them fairly short just so everybody gets a chance. Does this come off?
Yeah.
Yep, that's easier. Yes, I saw you first, sir.
I could ask Daniel for a bit more information about what's been happening in relation to the court action in PNG itself. Are you making any headway?
But it's been delayed. So as part of the case, we got to go inside the detention centre and an Australian journalist got to go inside and take a picture for the first time in 18 months. And asylum seekers got to come to court and give evidence about what their key concerns were. And all of those things in and of themselves were important wins. One asylum seeker, at the end of his evidence, turned to the judge and said, "Your Honour, I just want to say something. Thank you for starting this case, coming to court today and telling my story. Is the first time I felt human since I was sent here." So a lot has been accomplished already. Unfortunately, the PNG government appealed, saying that there were grounds to think that the judge hearing the case was biased, and that appeal halted the case, and the appeal has been adjourned, and then it's been adjourned again, and then it's been adjourned again. So reading the tea leaves, the tactic of the PNG government is to delay, and in the meantime, the inquiry just sits there, paused. It was a very important and very appropriate thing for the PNG courts to be doing, to be assessing whether what's happening on their turf complies with their laws. It's a shame that it's been halted. What was equally, or perhaps more concerning, was that we since learnt that the Australian government funded those appeals. So the Australian government was paying lawyers to stand up in the court of another country to make arguments to halt an important human rights appeal. So to answer your question, much has been achieved, much more may be achieved. For the time being, it's on hold. Our strategy may be to start again with a few individuals who are detained there, help them go to court and ask the court those same human rights questions, because it's a lot harder for a court to ignore a case that's commenced by a person than one that the court commences itself.
I've also got a question for you, Daniel. What scope is there for taking Australia to the International Court of Justice for perpetrating this abomination in setting up the detention centre on a place like Manus, whereas Ian Rentoul has clearly identified was a situation that was clearly set up to become an inferno and to create the divisions and the tensions and the frustrations and the anger which erupted in all the violence, the injuries, and the killings, and the death of Reza Barati.
Yeah.
What scope is there?
There's a few different accountability mechanisms for that. In terms of the international court that you refer to, there are some people who are taking that case up and who are looking at, you know, things like prosecution for crimes against humanity, things like that. For various technical legal reasons, there are difficulties with that approach. And I don't say that to be pessimistic, I just say that to be realistic. There are challenges with that. But there are other international accountability mechanisms. I mean, we've recently just delivered a statement to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. And the way that that international legal system works, it's not like a domestic court. You can't get an order saying, you know, do this or you're going to go to jail. But the reality is, now is a time of unprecedented global need when it comes to refugees. We learnt from the UN Refugee Agency just a couple of weeks ago that there are more displaced people in the world now than there have been since the end of the Second World War. So this is a time when many countries around the world are grappling with this challenge of how to meet the protection needs of 50 million displaced people. And when the rest of the world becomes increasingly aware that Australia is not sharing the burden, it's shifting it, and Australia is not keeping our promises, we're breaking them, Australia will have a price to pay. And I don't think that price is necessarily going to be, you know, the imprisonment of politicians or anything like that. I just think the price will be damage to our reputation and damage to our relationships with other countries. And those relationships are very important. And so I think increasingly that pressure from other countries who are dealing with similar challenges is a lever for change.
Oh yeah, I guess more of a comment and sort of in response to what you were saying at the end there, Daniel, about sort of the pressure coming on the Australian government, because I wanted to go back to this idea of you know, the government arguing that what they're doing is working and the ends justify the means and all that sort of business that we hear over and over in the media, because I think as people who support, you know, refugee rights, who support human rights, we have a real responsibility to shift that, you know, entire debate. I think, you know, we need to start with by actually questioning, well, when the government's saying it's working, what are their goals? You know, what are they trying to achieve when they say it's working? And do we actually support that to begin with? Because I would argue when the government says it's working, what they're trying to achieve there is to demonise refugees and asylum seekers, and to create this idea that they're, you know, a couple of hundred people coming on a leaky boat, that's the problem. You know, that's the thing that people should be focusing on and obsessing about and, you know, be concerned about. You know, while, you know, everyone else, while the government continues to strip funding from social services, from education, healthcare and stuff. And I think we need to actually say we reject that, you know, that argument to begin with, absolutely. And, you know, we welcome asylum seekers into our country. You know, if we want to see a system that's working, we want to see one that welcomes asylum seekers here, welcomes refugees, supports them in our community, lets them live in our community and gives them all the help and assistance that they need. That's what I would define, you know, to be working. So I think we should be quite confident in kind of not trying to, you know, respond to the government's sort of manoeuvrings about is it working, is it not, you know, are we stopping the boats, are we not, is there a boat, is there... It doesn't matter. Like, what the government is trying to achieve is, like, completely, you know, the opposite of what we want to see, which is a just and fair and humane society which welcomes asylum seekers and welcomes refugees with open arms.
I can't see people, sorry,
that's why
I'm standing up.
A comment. I mean, one of the most incredible things to come out of the parliamentary inquiry was that the Immigration Department overruled G4S to send a mobile squad in as a show of force at one point. And the PNG mobile squad has a long history going back to the Bergen World War and beforehand of credible allegations of rape and murder. And this is the, you know, the force that was sent in. And in that same sort of, you know, show of force type politics, Scott Morrison likes to talk tough when it comes to refugees. But I think that we need to understand that that's hubris on two levels. I mean, first of all, the secrecy comes about because they're not at all confident that the public shares their level of cruelty. I mean, that's why they have to talk about the story that there was a riot, the asylum seekers somehow brought it on themselves, Scott Morrison's thing that he tried to get out, that they were outside the centre at the start. It's because people don't share that level of cruelty, and they know that full well. And the other thing, I think, though, is the contradictions, which I think do matter at one level, because they're not in control in the way that they would like. You know, the boat that turned up recently does cause problems for Scott Morrison. Refugee numbers are continuing to build up in Indonesia. They went from 8,000 last year to 10,000 this year, recognised by the United Nations. There are cracks all over the place. But if we don't just want to see the next sort of horror foisted on refugees, then I think, you know, Ian's right that what we do now matters very much. If we can turn the Palm Sunday rallies from 10,000 to 20,000, I mean, certainly for those of you who aren't already involved in the Refugee Action Collective, we meet every Monday just across across the road, get involved. We'll be talking about the next steps in the campaign, future rallies and so forth, next Monday. I was visiting an asylum seeker, one of the ASIO people today, who's been inside for 5 years, and he was just saying the thing that struck him is it's just the obscene waste of money. And it is. There's $8 billion budgeted over the next 5 years. Mm. At the same time, they want to charge $7 to see the doctor. And I think that, you know, freeing refugees and being free to go to the doctor go hand in hand.
I was just actually going to ask a question, a little bit of a comment, but it'd be good if maybe Nicole could talk a little bit more about your experiences on Manus Island. And in particular, I've read all the statements that have been in the press and the statements put up by Refugee Action Collective about, what happened on Manus. But it'd be good just to get your take about, the other workers, the response of the other workers and so forth on Manus. And then I'd also like to encourage people to consider joining the Refugee Action Collective at the anti-budget rally that's happening on Sunday, because I think it is important at the anti-budget actions to keep have a refugee profile in there, because that is, Abbott Howard. that is one of the ways in which Abbott got elected, is through bashing refugees. So I think we do need to keep exposing the hypocrisy as well as arguing that Australia should be accepting all asylum seekers who need to come here. But anyway, that was...
Okay, thank you. When I got to Manus Island, I noticed that there was a division between the staff groups, and I really felt that there was a minority group which kind of thought that refugees and asylum seekers shouldn't be treated this way. We shouldn't be calling them by number. We shouldn't be denying them shoes when they ask, and we shouldn't be telling them, just go out and fill out another request form and wait 4 days whilst God knows what happens to your infected foot. So I feel like, in saying that, there was a group of people who, like I said, is the minority, and then there's a group of people who believe, or who are told to believe, that what they are doing is right. And there is a group of people there that think that following these orders and calling these people, A, B, C, whatever, is the right thing. And when you're part of that minority group, I do feel that you are victimized. And I feel that, you don't want to go around publicly saying your political opinion. You don't want to go around asking for shoes of your manager too many times, because you think, honestly, you think that you might be fired. So, for example, one of my colleagues, he lasted 3 days, and I knew that as soon as he arrived, he wouldn't last. The reason that he was let go was because he refused to call the asylum seekers transferees. And when he told Salvation Army management that he didn't want to refer to asylum seekers as transferees, he was on the next flight home. So there is a kind of secrecy that, we secretly do care what happens to these people. And then there's another group where you just pretend like, oh, everything's fine. Yes, I agree with what's going on here. But in saying that, for example, I know that a miner that was held in Old Mike compound asked me if he could have a clean toothbrush because he dropped his on the ground. And like I said before, it is filthy in Manus Island. It's disgusting. You wouldn't want to use that toothbrush again. So I went to my manager and I asked them, hey, do you mind if I get another toothbrush out of the shed for this guy? I said, no, you can't. He has to wait another month for the next lot of toothbrushes to go out. When I asked why, they said that he will cut it down on the ground and he'll use it to self-harm. So I was with another colleague and we were staying at this really fancy hotel in Airways, and we stole their toothbrushes from there. So we decided to give him a toothbrush that wasn't the conventional allowed approved toothbrush. So we snuck it in, we hid it in our pockets. Sorry, that kind of stuff was happening all the time. And I heard that a code was called a couple of hours later, and he had self-harmed and attempted suicide. And I thought that it was my fault because I wanted to give him this toothbrush that he had maybe used to do that. And then I started thinking to myself, well, maybe I'm on the wrong side. Maybe these guys are right. Maybe I shouldn't be sneaking around giving people extra stuff. Maybe I shouldn't be hiding Panadol in my pockets. Maybe I'm wrong. It turns out it wasn't the toothbrush. So I don't know if that's a relief or not, but I mean, it's very hard to, whilst you're there, to kind of distinguish what's right and what's wrong. And I think that that's something that's really hard to, for staff. And I know that there are good staff there. They just don't know what to do. And they just follow what is told. And it's such a long process to kind of get to the stage when you sit there and you think, hey, this is wrong. This isn't right. And what am I a part of? And who am I as a human being to call this man ABC, whatever, whatever, and say, no, you can't have shoes. No, you can't have a toothbrush. So, and it weighs a lot on your mind. And I think that, you know, I'm glad that I was on the other side, but being on that other side is really difficult. And you think that, you know, sometimes you are wrong. So, yeah.
What is the role of the Salvation Army?
Yeah, so... good question. my opinion was the Salvation Army was to provide humanitarian services. And I know in the past I haven't damned the Salvation Army too much, and I have been quite careful about what I've said about the Salvation Army, but their role was to provide humanitarian services, and I don't think that was delivered. I guess... You know, I can go around saying they tried their best, but I don't think that they did. And I think that the directive to provide these humanitarian services, whatever they were, I didn't see, I don't know what they were, recreational or something, wasn't delivered. And that was because of the Department of Immigration, the Australian Department of Immigration. They were always putting blocks on the Salvation Army. So if we asked, you know, hey, why isn't there internet in this compound and why is there internet here? They'll say, well, because DIAC said so. And I said, well, isn't your role to provide services for these people? Are you pushing? Are you pushing to get internet for these people, or are you just sitting back and accepting it? And I think everyone from management to ground staff got so disillusioned by what was happening that they just went with it, and they just thought, okay, well, that person's sick, so be it.
So were they paid by the Australian government? They weren't there as an NGO?
As far as I'm aware.
They were being paid by the Australian government?
Yeah,
contracted.
Which is now finished.
Yeah.
Hi, this might be for Nicole and Ian especially, but I'm just kind of interested because obviously it's a situation where these people have very limited ways of kind of getting their message across or their feelings across, but there have been kind of references to protests that go on within the detention centres. I was just wondering if you could tell us like a little bit more about the kinds of like actions or like organisational things that go on, maybe.
Do you want to?
What's sitting back?
No.
Okay. So there are all different kinds of protests. So I think, I mean, I kind of view self harm as a form of protest. And I guess I could even go as far as to say that, you know, suicide attempts would be a form of protest. But, I mean, they do a lot of organised chanting. They make their own signs. They've got bed sheets and they write slogans on it. I don't know if you've seen, but they say, like, we are human beings, you know, we are not criminals. And they actually, interestingly, make songs up and... chant them. And I know I was present when Scott Morrison came and they chanted some songs at him, and it was quite deliberate. Like, they knew what they were saying. They were chanting out that you think you're the king, here comes the king, and stuff like that. And yeah, and I mean, for me, when I first started, I was told that I shouldn't, you know, talk to them about protesting, and I shouldn't condone protesting, and particularly in Manus Island, because protesting is, I don't know, is it illegal? I don't know, but I was told it was. We were told, you know, don't support their protesting, don't support hunger striking, don't support anything like that. But in the end, myself and my colleagues were coming up with slogans for them to write on their bedsheets. So, yeah, But yeah, I mean, they're quite organised. They get together in little groups. And most of the time, I believe it's peaceful. And yeah, when Scott Morrison came, it was kind of fun. I asked to evacuate. My manager said, no, it's business as usual. I said, what the hell is business as usual? All these guys are protesting to Scott Morrison. And yeah, we chanted out to him. And it was, I'm bonding.
Yeah, I mean, Nicole's got a lot more experience than I have. I only know secondhand. But I think one of the things which demonstrates, though, is that the protests which led up to the 16th and 17th of February, you know, could really be happening in January, from January around Australia Day. So there have been many, many weeks of, you know, of peaceful protests, and that had been, as you know, Nicole's talked about, or there'd be marches sometimes, you know, protests around inside the, you know, inside the compounds themselves. At the moment, I haven't heard whether the Iraqis are still, you know, continuing in their protest. You know, they began a week or so ago, but that's taken the form of, of chants, of gathering together in groups in different compounds near the gates. Some people have been sleeping out overnight, you know, as a demonstration of their. As a demonstration, you know, they're not going to go back inside the compounds. They stay out overnight, sleep at the gates. You know, they chant. And but there's even little bits of footage, which I think probably sometime we need to kind of, you know, put some of those things together so that people can see the kinds of protests that were happening inside the detention centre. Because I think it is quite important. And I think, and if you go through the Cornell inquiry and the Senate inquiry, actually, and read between the lines in some cases, it is very clear that there were protests. There weren't, as the G4S statement or as the Cornell backs up, that somehow or other there were sections of, you know, detainees that were out to attack, the riots on the 16th and 17th, you know, were about sections of detainees actually attacking other sections of, you know, detainees. You know, people actually broke out on the night of went through the gate on the night of the 16th, but that was a protest. Where they were going, they didn't really know. They were going down the road. Some were going to church. Some perhaps thought they were, you know, might go down to the Bibby, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever else. But there are forms of protest that we readily identify with, and people do have a right to protest. And sometimes Scott Morrison is even, you know, even Scott Morrison has suggested there is a right to peaceful protest, in spite of the fact that, you know, he brutally suppressed the protests that were taking place on, you know, on Christmas Island. But also join the national protests that were happening about, you know, Reza Barati. But in that particular case, it's clear there was a peaceful protest, but that non-compliant behaviour that Scott Morrison suggested was enough to see, what, 5 wrists broken, people with their heads, you know, heads split open, people hospitalised. He can't blame that on, you know, G4S or the PNG government. He was responsible for that.
I had another question for Nicole, I guess, about how the workers were organising and so forth, because I think it's really heartening that, like, workers like yourself and like Mark Isaac and like all of these people continue to speak out, and then also there's like some element of non-compliance and not going along with like your job or whatever. It's kind of, I guess it goes against the whole, I guess they want to create a facade that like it's ironclad and they can rely on like these organisations to like provide like their role. And I think like Salvation Army's role, they might say it would be to provide humanitarian services, but I think in a lot of ways it's to provide a humanitarian cover to what's going on. I guess like it's a bit of an ideological thing, and I guess I wanted to know like you speaking out and like the comments you made about like they recruit people without any like skills or any knowledge of what's going on, whether there's like a downturn in like people signing up to go to Manus Island and Nauru, and whether like, I guess like that's one way in which we can expect that maybe the system can't go on, is that like they require people to do those jobs. Like it's not Scott Morrison who's the person like guarding the detention centres. It's not Scott Morrison who's actually building the fences on Nauru and Manus Island. Whether like, I guess like, was there organisation like, did workers discuss about like not complying with certain things, and you know, is there like, were you talking about like trying to discourage people from, I guess, taking jobs on Manus Island and Nauru? Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your question. Oh, did you turn it off for me? Thanks. Yeah. Actually, when I got to Manus Island, I'd been working there for Salvos for such a long time, and I had developed a sort of friendship group during that time. And when I got to Manus Island, like I said before, I went with a group of people from Nauru who were told that we were too traumatized to return to Nauru. And when we got to Manus, they just looked at me, and I remember them saying, you know, what are we doing here? You know, why are we here, and why are we assisting these people to hurt asylum seekers? Like, what's our role? So I remember a couple of, you know, quite often I'd go back to the Bibi Progress or HMS Chules at the time with accommodation and sit up late at night thinking of ways around this system and how to get the word out. Because we were scared to speak out. And we used to sit around wondering what it would take to get these places closed down. And to try and understand how horrible the place is and the mindset of the staff at the time, I remember explicit conversations where staff would state, you know, I think it will take a death to shut this down. But not just a suicide. It has to be, you know, a sickness, a malaria, a gastro or something like that. So now we've seen the death of Reza Barati at the hands of, God knows, people in some sort of power position. And the place is still open. So that was horrifying, because we used to sit around and think, you know, can we take in secret cameras? Can we take their documents? What can we do? How can we get around this? And, you know, there is groups of people on the island that think, you know, maybe we speak out, encourage more people to speak out, but it does become a bit draining that, you know, this place is still open, Reza has passed away, countless other people are injured, and this is still going on. And it's really hard to think about what to do next, which is why I think it's really great being here today and everyone's here interested in what's going on. It's really heartening, because I know when I was on island, I was just thinking, what am I supposed to do? And I don't think I discouraged other people from coming. I think I actually felt I encouraged other friends to come, because I wanted more people to see what it was like. There was a high turnover of staff though, so yeah, people came and went all the time. I think there's got to be hundreds of people who went through that system. But yeah, I did sit around with Mark Isaacs on Nauru going, what are we going to do to get this place closed? And he's like, oh, I don't know. So yeah, it took a long time. I mean, I was there for a year and a half, and, you know, I'm only here now. So, yeah.
One little quick thing. One of the issues that has also fueled things both on Nauru and on Manus Island is the massive, massive wage disparity. That you know, local PNG staff are paid $7 an hour for things that you know, expat staff are being paid $75 an hour. I think that is one of the things which fueled. There's been little bits of discussion from time to time with both unions of refugees here and you know, some people in PNG about whether that also may be a vehicle, you know, in terms of encouraging discontent amongst the, you know, people who are working inside the detention centre. I also think we should pay particular attention to what's happening with Peter O'Neill at the moment and the allegations and the demonstrations against O'Neill, because one of the things that have been raised in those protests has been the collaboration between the Australian government and the corrupt Peter O'Neill over Manus Island.
Is there any chance at all of organising strategies of contacting other international bodies such as the European Union with a view of imposing economic consequences such as sanctions, to put it extremely, or boycotts of Australian goods? Are there any attempts to run strategies along these lines?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't have the pull within those circles to achieve that. And I think, I mean, my view is it's likely to take form less directly than that kind of international pressure. I mean, we've seen huge numbers of boat arrivals in Italy, for example. And so I don't know that this international pressure is going to be a matter of other countries saying to Australia, if you don't change your policies, we won't trade with you or anything. I don't know that it will be that direct, but I think it's much more likely to sort of, as countries like Canada and Italy experience increased arrivals on their shores, potentially New Zealand. I mean, there was an asylum seeker boat intercepted off the coast of Sri Lanka that was apparently headed to New Zealand not that long ago. So as other countries increasingly grapple with this issue, and they see one of they see a country that ought to be a partner, a country that ought to help share responsibility, shifting it and breaking the rules, I think those conversations are probably going to happen behind closed doors, and it's a process. It's not going to be a matter of sort of another government or collection of governments saying do as we say or there will be consequences. It'll be much more diplomatic than that. But I don't know.
Other than the concern of Australian citizens over the refugee inhumanity, overseas politicians and residents don't vote in Australian elections. So how significant do you see that?
Well, when I talk about international opposition, I'm not necessarily talking about voters in Italy. I'm talking about the Italian government.
Yeah, I know, but the Italian government is not involved in the Australian elections.
No, but they things aren't made any easier for them when countries like Australia do as we do.
Sure.
And I think that that will be the issue that they take. And it is something that is being raised on the world stage. So the UN Human Rights, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights delivered her annual report a few months ago to the UN Human Rights Council, and she raised the human rights situation in Syria. She talked about issues in Egypt. She talked about North Korea. And she talked about the fact that Australia detains asylum seekers on remote Pacific islands. So we're in bad company, and the world is becoming increasingly aware of what we're doing, and they will become increasingly aware of the fact that it makes things more difficult for them.
Sure.
And for that reason, I think they'll take issue with it. But it's not a direct mechanism, because you're right. Italian citizens don't vote in Australian elections.
Well, in terms of the question about the international situation, I think it's sort of more contradictory than sort of positive pressure being brought to bear on the Australian government in terms of, you know, its human rights record, that Australia actually in many ways sort of leads the way in terms of pioneering racist and cruel approaches to asylum seekers and refugees that are then subsequently taken up by other countries who are also using the race card as a way to deflect, you know, hostility and anger around the economic crisis that's very much, you know, central to politics both in the UK and all throughout, you know, Greece and the European mainland. So we're seeing, you know, more and more kind of mandatory detention centres, ones built in Greece and what have you. The other thing that I thought was worth raising, I missed a lot of your introductions, it's late, but I think that any discussion about offshore processing needs to also have quite a critical element of it, or quite a big element criticising the Labor Party and the role that the Labor Party has played in paving the way for you know, the horror of, you know, the death of Reza Barati. Reza Barati was sent to Manus Island under the Labor government. It wasn't these detention centres were reopened under Gillard, and then it was Rudd that had the PNG solution, and it was under Labor that we had the 50-day long hunger strike of OMID on Nauru, you know, refusing to allow this, you know, emaciated, deteriorating man to, you know, to be brought to the mainland only at the very, very last minute, you know, no doubt has permanent health damage as a result of their refusal. You know, it was under Labor that you see the deportations without even being able to, you know, make a refugee claim. Over 1,000 Tamils just summarily deported under the, you know, the sort of, was it the screening out process. So, you know, the depths of refugee policy that we're seeing right now, it was Labor that took us, you know, even, you know, deeper than I think even Howard was able to take us in terms of the PNG solution. And I agree it's been kind of positive to see the, you know, the Palm Sunday mobilizations of 10,000 people, that we haven't seen some big protests like that for some time. And part of that is also because there's a whole series of people in the refugee kind of industry, or, you know, the refugee supporters who I think get thrown when it's the Labor Party doing it. Oh, maybe there's something that they're doing it from some place. It must be better than than the Liberals. It could be worse. Oh, you know, I'm a bit confused about the deaths at sea argument. Whereas people are much more clear, oh, when it's Abbott, you know, there's no kind of, you know, humanitarian veneer. They're clear it's just about pure racism. But nonetheless, that's also what, you know, like Labor at times used the deaths at sea argument, but also demonised and so on. And I think that for the refugee movement to get stronger, we both have to respond right now to the horrors of the Abbott government, but also be clear that the Labor Party provided no alternative either, and that really makes an argument for the need for building that grassroots activist movement on the streets that can, you know, so Cecilia was saying, you know, we need to be putting out our argument. We're not, it's not about just sort of lobbying those in Parliament because they're going to somehow get a good heart. No, they have an interest in this dividing policies and deflection and so on. So yeah, I think that hopefully, you know, like the movement can become a bit stronger under Abbott, but when we get a Labor government in as well, we need the fight to continue, not to have, you know, whole hiatus of, you know, years before we can rebuild again when, you know, Labor get back in.
Yeah. For Daniel, is there any option within the Constitution for invoking an impeachment? Yeah, because that would be a direct action way of dealing with this problem, maybe.
There was a case recently that was taken to the High Court that challenged the constitutionality of the decision to set up Manus, and the case failed, and it failed resoundingly. And I think that that's just because, I mean, parliaments in Australia have very broad powers to make whatever laws they want. There are very few limitations on that power. We don't have a Bill of Rights in Australia. PNG does.
Yeah.
It's now weaker because of us, but we don't have one in our own constitution. And that makes things hard when you've got laws like this. And so at the moment it seems like offshore processing will end on the basis of a decision that is taken in Parliament, not on the basis of a decision that's taken in a courtroom.
Yep. One more of a comment and question. I think at the moment there's such a strong focus on closing Manus as opposed to ending our offshore processing period. And my concern is that what may happen is that the government may close Manus and move people to Nauru, because that's where a lot of the lobbying is coming from. There seems to be such a strong focus on closing Manus as opposed to closing both offshore processing centres, and I think that's just something that we need to be maybe aware of when, you know, when you go to protests and a lot of the time the chants are close Manus, you know, we need to stop Manus. And the death of Razabrati obviously has highlighted Manus as horrible, horrible place to send people, but I think it's important for us all to just remember that both places are definitely not somewhere I'm going to attend.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, yeah, that tonight has focused on Manus because of Nicole being there, but well, speaking for me, I presume speaking for Rack, we want all closed.
I might add something to that. I mean, so my, and this sort of goes to what was being said before about what the goal of our policy should be. And I think, other advocates will take their own position. My view is that as soon as you start talking about deterrence in this context, you're missing the point. People get on boats when they lack options. All deterrence policies aspire to do is give them one less. Really, every time a boat arrives and every time a person drowns en route to Australia, it does show that we failed, but not that we failed to frighten them away, that we failed as a region to develop a system whereby people who need protection can access it safely without getting on a boat. So for me, the issue is not with Manus, it's not with Nauru, it's not with Christmas Island, it's not with TPVs, it's with any policy that has as its goal giving people who lack options one less.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for all of your comments. feeling that way, and I'm just wanting to know, probably from each one of you, where to from now. Like, there's, you know, a great banner behind you, and the big thing that stands out for me is justice. Like, where to from now for the Justice for Reza Barati, and where to, you know, legally with the workers on Manus, and politically, what, you know, where to, where can we draw all this emotion, and where can we actually start to get some sort of you know, wins finally? Because, you know, we just don't want another Reza Barati. I don't want another T-shirt that says 100 days, still no justice. Like, we, yeah, I'm sure we all are getting quite emotional around this issue, and it would be good to put our emotions into a direction.
I can say a couple of things about that, but I suspect it's an ongoing discussion amongst the Refugee Action Collective down here, as it is with the, you know, the groups all around Australia. And I said that one of the meetings, which is a bit of a historic meeting, I think, the 1,300 people in Canberra who carried, like, unanimously and resounding applause, a very clear statement, I think the statement that was used here on your recent leaflet, maybe for the, you know, Palm Sunday or the rally. And I think that is one of the indications that, in spite of what's happening at the top in the Parliament, I think there are serious cracks. And if you look at the in their policy about serious cracks in the Australian community, and I think if anything, the institutional and community support is swinging our way. You know, like, you look at this kind of increasingly the statements that are coming from from the churches. You know, for example, I can't think of many institutions now, or the institutions that matter, whether you're talking about, you know, the College of Physicians, the AMA, you know, various peak bodies of lawyers and so forth, actually, who are all, you know, adamantly opposed to, if not the total aspect, they don't agree with everything that, you know, that RAC actually says, but they're absolutely critical of offshore processing and what the government is doing. And I think it's that out of that kind of confidence, you know, that there is ground to be made, that the stalls, the leafleting and the protests actually make some difference. I mean, I'd like to sit here and say, you know, we're not going to see another Reza Barati, but I doubt that that's the case. I think they've set up a system which is designed to deliver, yeah, you know, Reza Baratis and to strike terror in the hearts of the, you know, of the asylum seekers. But what matters when that does happen is there is a campaign that actually, you know, is able to respond. And I think we do need to build much deeper roots. I think the creation of unions for refugees in Sydney, we need to, you know, sink those roots, look to build those union contingents in the, you know, in the rallies that we, you know, that we have, you know, where we actually take them. I don't think we want them to let them forget Reza Barati. If we want to make sure there's not one more Reza Barati, then there does need to be more protests that say never again and no more Reza Baratis. And I think we should look to some of those anniversaries over the, you know, over the coming period to make, you know, exactly that point, that Reza Barati is not going to be forgotten. And the point that was made, you know, over there, it is constantly, it's not just Manus Island, it is offshore processing, but we need to make sure that if Manus Island is closed because of the pressure that's around that, that it is a victory for the campaign. And that's only going to be if we do go out and actually say close Manus Island, you know, close Nauru. So I don't know that there's I know there's not a quick fix. If we found a quick fix, we would have done that, you know, a while ago. But I think there's so many opportunities at the moment to sink much deeper roots into the community. And so I think there is an opening and a, you know, for the arguments and a kind of responsibility for the campaign itself. If we're going to, I think we have done a lot already to kick that you know, the stop the boats prop out from underneath, you know, Morrison and you know, and Abbott. I think we've done a lot actually to impact, you know, on a particularly difficult, you know, labor leadership, and we have to continue to try and campaign to remove the bipartisan support. It's not to say I'm necessarily, you know, optimistic, you know, that Richard Marles and Bill Shorten are about to turn over, but I think there is clearly a hearing in the unions, in the Labor Party itself, as Labor Party membership, and certainly people who vote Labor, for a very different outlook. And I think we need to go out with some confidence and encourage all those MPs that have spoken out to continue, you know, to speak out and to campaign. And we'll certainly be looking at the Labor Conference, the National Labor Conference next year, to have a lobby outside that to make it very, very clear. The statement is going to be given to politicians from the the Canberra public meeting, and it's also there's also going to be thousands of signatures from petitions at RAC in Victoria being collected that will be delivered, you know, at that time, you know, as well. So, in one respect, it's you know, it's more of the same, but better and deeper and stronger. But because I think we have made the gains, and too often I think we listen to Scott Morrison. And think perhaps we have it, but I think you look behind, you know, that ugly veneer of the government, you can see a very different picture.
Australians, the expats who worked as the actual prison guards or what have you on in Nauru and Manus. Can you describe kind of the social background they came from or their mentality?
So, to my knowledge, when I was there, a lot of the guards were ex-army or ex-prison officers or officers, ex-police officers, and they came from that background that was really regimented, to my opinion. To be honest with you, I didn't talk to many GFRS guards because I didn't want to. Sorry. And I feel really awkward because we have one GFRS guard in the audience right now, so, you know. But I just feel that as to generalise and to stereotype them, I feel that they had a poor attitude towards the asylum seekers, and I don't know whether it was because they came from these backgrounds or they were there for the job or you know, they had problems back home and they needed to pay the bills. I don't know. But I did say in my statement that I witnessed expatriate G4S guards beat an asylum seeker unconscious. I heard them talk derogatory to children. I heard them incite fear into asylum seekers and tell them these are cannibals outside. But in saying that, I mean, I'm not going to damn more, but you know, I just feel that the work culture was awful. And Salvation Army and GFRS did not have a good relationship, and neither did the whole IHMS as well. I don't think nobody really communicated and nobody really got along. And on the ground stuff, there was a lot of tension between the two. I mean, you've got welfare workers trying to get, you know, something for someone, and a GFRS guard just trying to do his job as well. So we had a lot of tension and a lot of problems. And the work environment outside of work and inside of work wasn't great. It was, you know, we didn't have a good relationship. We didn't really get along. I know I didn't. I stayed away from them most of the time. And yeah, I guess because we're all on a kind of secret island so far away, we're all bound by these magical confidentiality agreements, people thought they could do what they wanted and get away with it. And that is actually what's happened. So, yeah.
Sorry, I know you didn't ask this question of me, but I'm going to chime in anyway. My impression, having walked through the place and spoken with a few people who work there, is it's just like any cross-section of the community. There's good people, there's bad people, there's indifferent people. And I think the difficulty for them is that they're in a situation where the absolute best they can do is slightly soften the edges of an incredibly harsh situation. I think it's difficult to speak too generally about people who work there, because some of the best information I've ever got about exactly what happens on the ground has come from those people.
Yeah.
Potentially some of the worst injustices that have been perpetrated against asylum seekers have been perpetrated by those people. So it is very difficult to generalise.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to thank the speakers again. I think it has to go a little bit. It's hard for us to imagine without being there, so this has certainly made it a lot more real to me. What I'd like to say to you tonight is use this information. When you leave here, you didn't just come here to listen. Go out, start the conversation, speak to your colleagues, speak to your friends, speak to your family. Come to rallies, go to marches, join RAC. As we said, we meet every Monday night at 6:30 at the ANF building in Elizabeth Street. If you already go to protests, bring someone else. If you already do stuff, get someone else, double the numbers, etc. Thank you very much again for coming out on a cold night. There's tea and coffee at the back, if you would like. And RAC's all right now.